Today we're going to study about today. Today is the 5th of Tevet in Jewish calendar. 5th of Tevet in Chabad is a very happy day. The story starts a long time ago, as usual. Every Jewish story starts a very long time ago. You know, the Jewish people are called the people of the book. Even that's not a Jewish compliment, not the Jewish people gave the compliment to the Jews, the people of the book, but it's still a true statement. Because the whole of Judaism stands on the Torah. Without the book, we are nothing. Then the Jewish people constantly were busy with having the book, first of all, the Bible itself, to write it down. Think about it, days before printing. Everything was writing. Everything had to be written down on paper and with parchment and ink. It was a very, very hard job. Then anybody who had the Bible, the 5 books of Moses, it was a treasure. And then it was the prophets, and then it was the scriptures, and it was all a business of writing. The Jewish people were busy writing and writing and writing and writing. And then when it came the commentary, and then the Talmud was written 2,000 years ago, over 300 years, maybe more even, a period of 300 years, the Mishnah and the Talmud. Everything had to be committed to paper, to writing. And there were in the Jewish people, many, many people, that the whole job was to be scribes. They made a living from it. You order a book, you hire basically a person to write for you the book. Whatever time it takes and the effort and the paper and the ink and all and so on. There are 36 tractates of the Talmud. Thousands of pages. And having books in Judaism was a huge treasure, especially if you're a scholar, if you're a rabbi, and you need to learn, you need to take your knowledge from somewhere and to review it. And before you issue a ruling, you look again in the book. And in general, in Judaism, learning Torah is not, I'm going to college, I need to graduate, and then I never look at the book again. In Judaism, learning Torah is a labor of love. We enjoy to learn Torah. We learn it, and at the same time, we find more meaning and more. It's the way of connecting with God. The Torah is the wisdom of God. Then if I want to understand how God thinks, I have to learn Torah. I get into God's mind, so to speak. The mitzvahs are more the will of God. God wants me to put on film. God wants me to light candles. God wants me to do this. Then that's what I do. I do what he asks me to do, what he says. But if I want to get God, to start to think like God, I have to learn Torah. There is a huge difference how people think, how the world thinks, and how people learn Torah think. It's actually the opposite. It's a different way of thinking altogether to looking at the world. Then all of this comes from the books. Then the more books you add, the more power you add, because knowledge is power. And especially great rabbis, their life was the book. They lived the book. They learned it. It was there. It was not just a book. You read it, you put it back on the shelf, and you do what you want to do. When you live by the book, not just you read, it's not just information. It's a way of life. It's your life. Then the book is everything. Now, the first Chabad rabbis were the same. The first Chabad rabbi, Shneur Zalman of Liadi, when he became a rabbi, he wrote books. He updated the code of Jewish law. He wrote also the Tanya. He wrote himself his own books, but it's always based on books from before it. In Judaism, everything is based. Remember when somebody sits and fantasizes something, an idea that came from his head, and he just makes up, he writes it. It's not fiction. This is real. Then he collected books, and the Hasidim, they knew that the Rebbe needs books. And obviously, it was for them the biggest honor to give the Rebbe, to buy a book and to give it to the Rebbe. There were old manuscripts and so on. Then little by the Chabad Rebbe's, every generation, the library became bigger and bigger and bigger. There were also fires, you know, in the Shtetlach in Europe, it was a fire and it used to burn down things. Now, that was the books that they got from other authors throughout Jewish history. There are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Jewish text of books from rabbis who wrote commentaries to the Bible and to the Talmud. There is no end to it. But there is also their own writings, or they wrote new commentaries to the Torah, to Hasidus, to Kabbalah, to everything. Many of them was lost, many of them was preserved. They went in great length to preserve their writings and the books that they had. And it came all the way, there's seven Chabad rabbis, seven generations, talking about 250 years. The sixth Chabad rabbi, he became a rabbi in 1920, right after World War I, right? And they sent the books at that time, they were running away from Lubavitch, and they sent the book to, I think, to St. Pete, to Moscow, to put it in a safe. And then it was, I think they got some of the book, they didn't get some of the book, it was very hard, you know. But then the communists came to power. Nothing is used, everything is confiscated. Then they lost the books, then they bought all the books. In any case, when the previous rabbi had to leave Russia, they didn't want to let him go, take the books with them. That he said to the guy, to the KGB, without the books, I'm not leaving. That the guy was talking to the KGB, he said, Rabbi, you cannot talk to them like this. He told them, I'm not a little boy. I'm telling you, go and tell them that without the books, I'm not leaving. They sent another guy, and he approved everything, and he left with his books, with everything. And he went to Riga, then was World War II, and the books were left in Poland, and they went other places. It was a whole nightmare. Then part of the books they redeemed in 1977, the Polish government was ready. There was a communist government too. American government turned to them and they gave back the books. Part of the books are still in Moscow. Putin doesn't want to release them. He gave it to Chabad in Moscow, but Chabad in Moscow means Putin. it's in Russia still. In any case, the library that the previous Rebbe, the sixth Chabad Rebbe, he came in 1941 to America, and he bought 770, and there in the basement and in his own apartment, he had a lot of books. 1950, the Rebbe passed away. Everything stayed the same, nothing changed. The Rebbe became Rebbe, but the library isn't the same, everything's the same place. Then in 1985, a librarian saw that there is some books are missing in shelves. You know, in the beginning you don't pay attention, a book here, a book there, you don't realize what's going on. You see, something is wrong. Books are missing. Then decided to put up a surveillance camera in 1985, was considered a big thing. And they realized it was a grandson of the previous Rebbe. His name was Berry Gurari. And he used to come in. He was not religious. He left the movement. He did not have children. And he just decided to steal the books and to sell them, to make money from it. And somebody comes to a person who has money and he collects books and tells him, this is a book from the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, or from the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, even his handwriting in his inside. Mm. It's worth a lot of money. Besides, old books are worth a lot of money. This is coming from a very holy person. Like
from what I heard, like he thought he was like the right...
We're getting there.
Heir to the Rebbe.
Yeah. First of all, he wasn't the only heir. Mm-hmm. There were the two daughters were still alive. The previous Rebbe had three daughters. One daughter perished in the Holocaust. The other two daughters came to America. One was the wife of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe Tzon Chaim Mushka. The other daughter was Hannah. She was married to a Gorari. Her husband was also a chassid of the Rebbe and a part of the Chabad movement. His son left. Now, even if it's true that it belongs to him, why you steal? And more than that, not everything belongs to you. There is two daughters, right? That's FNI. What do you mean you come in, steal, and you're selling? Do whatever you want. In any case, when they saw that they stole, they reached out and said, just give back the books and we will not report to the police, nothing. Let's go to a rabbinical court and we'll walk out like every two people have a dispute, they go to a rabbinical court. He says, no, he doesn't believe rabbinical court. He wants the court. He wants the secular, the court, the system, the court system from America, the secular court to decide, the civil court to decide who is right and who is wrong. But first of all, the Rebbe's secretary went and he took out a restraining order to stop selling the books. They were already selling the books in Israel. It was going on for 6 months until the Rebbe heard about it. Mm. the Rebbe was upset is an understatement, because it was his father-in-law's book. And then the Rebbe started to talk about what's the problem. Not just that he takes books. The Rebbe said if he would wanted money, we would give him money. If he's hungry, if he needs money, we'll give him money. But the books, by a tzaddik, the books are his life. When you learn Torah, a piece of him, a piece of his spirit, so to speak, is in his books. Then when you take, the Rebbe said, when you take a book and you sell it, you're making him another funeral, another leviah. That's how the Rebbe spoke. And but more than that, the Rebbe was looking at the whole thing, that the previous Rebbe never died. Spiritually, he never died. Physically, he died. But spiritually, he never died. What means he never died? The movement continues to live. It was based on the concept of Jacob. It's written, we're going to read it in this week's parsha, next week's parsha. It's written, that when Jacob died, it's written by the Torah. When Abraham died, it's written and he died. When Isaac died, it's written the world died. By Jacob, it's not written that he died. It's written, and Jacob expired. That's what's written. Then the Rashi says, right on the spot, it comes from the Talmud, Jacob never died. What do you mean? Here, Jacob never died. He died, too bad, don't bring Jacob. Jacob never died. Rabbi Yochanan said that the author of the Jerusalem Talmud says, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Yaakov Avinu Leimez, Jacob never died. But the question is, the Talmud is asking, but it was a funeral, it was a eulogy. We read in the Torah that he died and they buried in Jacob. So, big deal, we don't get worked out because we have a question. The answer is, as long as his children are alive, Jacob is alive. Jacob's children continue the Jewish tradition, all his 12 children, with the selling of Joseph, with all the bad news, with Dinah, the bottom line, they were all Jewish, that Jacob is still alive. Then, that means Jacob has never died. The Rebbe said, basically, it's true about every tzaddik. The previous Rebbe was not a private person. He was the Rebbe of the Chabad movement. The books are not his books, so to speak. They are, then if he has children, if he has disciples who continue the Chabad, his philosophy, then basically he's alive. Then we're not going to divide his inheritance. The movement continues. Then it boiled down to the question, is the library belongs to the Rebbe personally, or it belongs to the Chabad movement? Now, you need to understand, when a Chosid came to the Rebbe and gave him a book, he didn't think about the Chabad movement, he gave the Rebbe. That in our Hasidim mind, it's all the Rebbe's. But in the Rebbe's mind, it all belongs to the Hasidim, you understand? Then the question was, would a federal judge understand, be able to figure out what is a Hasidic movement? He never heard of Chabad, he never heard of Hasidim. The Jewish people have a Rebbe in Hasidim, and it's a community in Greek, it's not a private thing. A regular person would come and say, that's what your grandfather, that's yours. What do you drink, me a cup of Hasidim?
You mean judge never heard about Chabad?
We can find one judge who didn't hear about Chabad.
They know about the church, they know about the Vatican, and they know about that movement. There's other.
Oh, that's different.
Very different than today.
Yeah, people know about Chabad, especially in New York. But still, actually, the judge later said that Chabad, even 7th century, even if it's not a glass building, open glass building, but you know what's going on there.
Has anyone ever tried to, any president tried to take, you know, they get gifts all the time from...
You're not allowed to take gifts from the White House.
Presidential libraries.
Right, but has any president said, hey...
But you can argue. Yeah. But let's say
I mean, this never came up.
But the president comes into the White House.
Okay. I'm not talking about
to the White House. You walk into the White House. When you walk out, here a rabbi is something that comes. It was a rabbi for 30 years.
Right. But when a
what
president
to say is, the question is like this: can you argue that he doesn't have one? How many books he has personally, and how many books are the library? It was all one thing. You understand? That the Rebbe was very worried about this court case. To say very worried is an understatement.
So who?
Then they went to court.
Who tried the case?
Oh, it was a federal judge.
Where did the
Jewish?
No,
I think I asked this before, but where did the
federal judges, some of them not Jewish?
Where did the grandson get all the money to...
Oh, Regards and garden money, at that time, the Satmar Hasidim from Billingsburg were against Chabad. Yeah. Then they found a place where to bite Chabad. That they sponsored the court case.
Really?
He did not have the money, this kind of money.
Right, nobody does.
Hasidic Jews did it, you understand? Really? They hired the best lawyer. The lawyer later said, the Chabad lawyer speaks in many Chabad events every time this year. In one of the speeches, he said that the other lawyer told them that he never lost a case before that.
Hmm.
Yeah? They took the best lawyers available. Chabad also took good lawyers. In any case, the Rebbe looked at it also as a spiritual, if from God is coming such a thing, and that it's being challenged in court. He said that Chabad movement basically died after the sixth Rebbe. Finished. There's no Rebbe. And therefore, everything belongs to him. Oh, my uncle became Rebbe? I don't recognize it. We don't recognize it. He and his mother won on one side, and the Chabad was on the other side. And they went to court. The Rebbe met with the lawyers twice before the court. And he concentrated on one letter that the previous Rebbe wrote. When he came to America, he made a lot of efforts to get the library from Poland. And he wrote a letter to Dr. Marx, who was the head of the Jewish Theological Library in New York. He should write to the White House, to the State Department. They should ask for the books. Then he writes him in the letter. The books belong to the Chabad umbrella organization. It belongs to the Jewish people. It's not a private thing. Really clearly. The Rebbe took this letter. He told the lawyers, this is the case. Here lays our case. And they also listened, but they collected thousands of documents. It was a huge, huge, huge job for months. Many people worked on it. They finally went, the court date came. It was the court started on the 19th of Kislev. The 19th of Kislev, that's the first Chabad Rebbe came out from jail. That was a day of celebration by Chabad, a day of redemption. Basically, it's a good day for Hasidim. Then when it started on the 19th of Kislev, I was there in 770 at that time. We knew it's going to be good. There was no question that the Rebbe is going to win the case. The Rebbe himself was very stressed about it. During the court case, the Rebbe went, many of you were by the oil. The Rebbe went to the Rebbe's father-in-law's gravesite every day. On the court. What means to go every day? When you go to the oil, you don't eat, you don't eat drink, you don't eat until after the oil. The Rebbe was at that time 85 years old, or 86, and the Rebbe only drink is to go like 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, is to go to the oil more, 1 o'clock, come back after when it's night, and then Dav Michemai, then go home to eat something. 3 weeks. 86-year-old man. You understand what it means? It's like unbelievable. And I saw the toll it took on his health at that time. It was very, very serious. And when we went to the court case, I didn't understand a word of English. Therefore, I only went a few times. But always guys who translated for all, and the benefit of all the handicaps who didn't understand English. Then I was there for twice or three times throughout the court case. And the place was full, but everybody was on his best behavior because not to make the judge upset and everything. And everybody was sitting in the court and saying psalms to himself. But it went on for a long time. One of the famous witnesses that came on the side of Chabad was Elie Wiesel. He came, so to speak, as an expert of what is a Hasidic movement. The fight was between the two sides. Is a Hasidic movement a private business or a community business? And the truth is, it's a community business. It's not a private business. The person who becomes the next Rebbe, even in every movement, he inherits, he is a continuation of the whole system. It's not like everybody takes for this and runs away. Then, let's say the Rebbe lived in a big house. Let's say. He didn't sell the house and everybody divides it. The next Rebbe continues in the same place, you understand? Then it belongs to the community. But they wanted to argue that it's a private business. It's a private thing.
You can steal, how did one after another? I mean, if it's he took the books and trying to sell it, how he could do it anyway? It doesn't matter if it's a...
No. Let's say if you divide in the library to two daughters, she takes half of the library, you take half of
He was claiming he has rights.
Yeah, that's what this is. Yeah, that's what he claimed. He claimed he's a grandson and he deserves a half of the library.
But you're saying, stealing is stealing.
That's for sure, no question about it. But the question is, okay, we're going to go now after we solve the stealing problem, let's say. To who the library belongs? That was the question. To who Chabad to this all belongs? Is there a Chabad movement or not?
Rabbi, question is, for all these books which we were talking about, which were stolen, the rights and everything, were available for public for anyone? Anyone can go
for,
and look
no,
at it?
No, it was not for anyone, but for scholars, for people who want to do research. And they have to get special permission and they go into the library. It was not available for every child. It's not a public library.
Right.
It was not, even now, the library is more open, but still... You have to make an appointment and come in and fill up information what you want. And yeah, exactly. For example, my father's machzer, his handwritten machzer, I told you about it. My father gave it to the Rebbe. It ended up in the Rebbe's library. The Rebbe put it was in his office for
the handwritten until then, one that he wrote.
That he himself wrote. He gave it as a gift to the Rebbe. He put it in the library. When we came, we wanted a copy of it. We went to go to the librarian and to ask for him. And he gave us permission. He made a few faces, but he gave us permission to make a copy of it.
So all those books are available, as even on a copy or documented?
Now everything is online.
Online.
Everything is online. Everything is online now.
That's how we live.
And now people can learn from online. They don't have to go to the library even. Everything is online.
Is the online version like this, or is it handwritten?
Whatever that's scanned, whatever it's scanned is scanned.
Where
yeah, that's
find,
the idea.
Where do you find that?
I think you can go online and find everything. It's open to the public. No, it's not Chabad at all.
No.
But it's I think a Chabad library. I'll tell you the truth, I never went to this.
But
there is even there online, one of the most important manuscripts there was the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, had a scribe writing for him a Siddur. Even it was time of printing, he wanted to read in Siddur. A scribe wrote for him a Siddur. And he used to write, in the other side, he used to write the names of people that he prayed for, Yaakov ben Esther. And it's a very, and there is even drops of blood from his eyes that when he used to daven so hard, used to, sometimes blood came out and the prayer books. Wow. And this manuscript was by the Rebbe.
Was that in the 1700s?
Yeah, 300 years ago. Yeah. Then this book, even this, is now online available. A copy of it. Then that was the whole. For 3 weeks was going on the court case, but then they're waiting for the issuing ruling. And Chabad brought their witnesses. They brought the other witnesses. It was very complicated. Let's read a little bit the letter from the previous Rebbe to Dr. Marx, where the Rebbe said, "This is everything." Want to start?
Letter to Dr. Marx. To a large extent, the decision turns on what the judge calls one extraordinary letter from Rabbi Joseph Schneerson, the sixth Rebbe, to an American scholar, Dr. Alexander Marx, the former head of the library at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. The letter was written in 1946 as part of the rabbi's effort to get the library out of Poland. Leaving the books behind, the rabbi had fled the Nazis 6 years earlier and set up a new Lubavitch headquarters in Brooklyn. There are several thousand books among them, many ancient books of great value and very rare. These books are the property of Agudas Hasidic Chabad of America and Canada.
Agudas Hasidic Chabad means the umbrella, the Lubavitch Chabad umbrella organization. It's their property. He writes it in the letter. Continue.
The manuscripts are registered under the names of the members of Agudas Hasidic Chabad, Rabbi Jacobson or Rabbi Hecht, both American citizens who are the official owners of this property.
That's what he writes. Now, read the next paragraph.
I turn to you with a great request, Rabbi Schneerson wrote, that as a renowned authority on the subject, you should please write a letter to the State Department to testify on the great value of these manuscripts and books for the Jewish people in general, and particularly for the Jewish community of the United States, to whom this great possession belongs.
Then the Rebbe writes clear that the possession belongs to the Jewish people, to Agudas Hasidic Chabad. It's not a private thing.
Can I ask a quick question? Who are Rabbi Jacobson and Rabbi Hecht?
Rebbe Chabad Hasidim.
So why were Americans, they the owners of?
Because you need somebody. Who is a good steel company? Who is the umbrella organization? You need names, right?
Okay.
It was not their private. They were they were on the board.
They were just a nominated
one. There was a nominated one on the board, on the public board, on the community board, on the nonprofit organization. That the books belongs to them. Now, they were arguing that he wrote it only to get the books out. He didn't really mean it. You understand? And the Rebbe said, a Rebbe doesn't lie.
Mm-hmm. He's not deceived.
He said, exactly. The Rebbe, then the argument was, you have to hope that the judge will understand what a Rebbe is, that a Rebbe doesn't lie. You understand? You know, many people do. You know, I was the book is stuck in Europe. We need to get it out. We'll do everything we can to get it out. We'll write on this year, my new name, help me. We'll do any shtick to get it out, right? And the Polish government does. It doesn't belong to them. They're thieves. They were hoping that a judge who never heard what the Rebbe is will understand that the Rebbe never lies. It's not so simple. That was a very tricky thing. He never lies and it's not private. There were a lot of concepts that you were hoping that a total stranger who is not Jewish, who never heard of anything, will take one letter, take it at face value. Go ahead, continue.
Lawyers for the defendant characterized the letter as duplicitous and of a piece with the wartime letters in German intended to be read by the Nazi censor, according to the judge.
Duplicitous. What is this mean?
Duplicitous.
What is that?
Deceitful.
Deceitful. Yeah, okay, it's a nice word. Okay. But judge, continue.
But Judge Sifton rejected the argument.
Judge Sifton was a righteous Gentile.
The dupli is like double. Go ahead. Two meanings.
Go ahead.
Not only does the letter, even in translation, ring with feeling and sincerity, he wrote, it does not make much sense that a man of the character of the Sixth Rebbe would, in the circumstances, mean something different than what he says. That the library was to be delivered to plaintiff for the benefit of the community.
This was the question, would he understand it? That a man, a character like the Sixth Chabad Rebbe doesn't lie, if we will get enough to, he will take the time to understand and to study who the Sixth Chabad Rebbe was, to understand that these things doesn't happen like this. Okay, now, on the last day of the court, they also insisted to make a get the Rebbe's wife deposition to ask her questions with lawyer. Their lawyers came to take a deposition. They wanted to take the deposition from the Rebbe itself, and it was very upsetting to us that lawyers sit down and ask the Rebbe questions and try to trick him and this. And finally, it was canceled. But the Rebbetzin said, I will go. She said, I have no problem. And she gave her deposition a few hours. I was actually, in this day, I was in court. By the end of the court, by the end of the deposition, they asked her, that was before the court case, they asked her, what do you think? What do you think? What do you really think? Who belongs to the library? To your father or to the Hasidim? And our lawyers, the Chabad lawyers, wanted that the court should hear, and the last day the judge says he wants to hear. He wants to see the deposition of the Rebbe's wife. Okay, go ahead.
Judge Sifton requests to see excerpts of the videotaped deposition of Rebbe Simchai Amushka, granddaughter of fifth Rebbe, Rabbi Shalom Dovber Schneerson.
She was a granddaughter of the fifth Chabad Rebbe, continue. The daughter
of the sixth Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, and spouse of the seventh Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem.
Not bad, huh?
That's what you call a pedigree.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
A television screen is brought into the courtroom, placed on the judge's desk facing him. For some 20 minutes, Judge Sifton sits transfixed to the screen while the Rebbetzin's soft but assuring voice permeates through the courtroom. Finally, at the very end, the following exchange played before
the Rebbetzin gave answers. As the Rebbe later said, she passed the two with flying colors. Hmm. She gave sharp answers. I saw part of the position later years. It was... She was 87 years old at that time, 85. She gave very, very clear and sharp answers. She knew what to say, what not to say, but many times she said, I don't remember. The lawyers on the other side are trying to trick you in more and more and more. Okay, continue. Danny, you want to continue?
Question. To your knowledge, in terms stuff that your mind, the book, open the library, did they belong to your father or did they belong to the president?
They asked her, what do you think? After everything, that was the end of it. What do you really think? Here is what she answered.
I think it belonged to the Hasidim because my father belonged to the Hasidim.
She said something that was never heard before. She said the books belong to the Hasidim because my father himself belongs to the Hasidim. A Rebbe belongs to the Hasidim. Now, who can say it? Only the Rebbe can say it. A Hasid cannot say, the Rebbe belongs to me. When you bought him exactly? What do you mean he belongs to you? You belong to him, not he belongs to you. But she said, as a daughter and a granddaughter of Rebbe's, and a wife of a Rebbe, she said, if you want to know what a Rebbe is, the Rebbe doesn't have a private life. He doesn't have anything personal. His all essence belongs to the Hasidim. When the lawyers heard it, they got so upset of this answer. That was the end of the deposition. That was it. They throw the pens on the table. But here is what the judge reacted.
This is probably a statement like taught to every future rabbi. This kind of like just...
Absolutely.
This is a statement, you know? Like, keep in mind who you are and whatever. It's
okay. Well, isn't it?
And actually, when the rabbi's wife passed away, the rabbi in one of his talks mentioned that she said that was a line unbelievable.
What? Doesn't it like tie into like what we always learn? Like, you're like... very little ego, being humble. No, like you don't own yourself.
Learning and doing is two separate things, my friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean,
yeah, but they were annulled.
No, to a point. Yeah. The question was, they're asking that the previous rabbi, the Isidar, his prayer book was his or not? You want to tell me he had nothing? Nothing is. Mm. You understand? That was the problem here. Nothing. Not even one book is his. Mm. He had like a whole bunch of books on his desk. This also doesn't belong to him. Out of where you go.
She was very private also, wasn't she?
She was a very private person. Nobody ever heard her talking even. Suddenly, at this deposition, she spoke such brilliant things in this age. Hmm. I remember to hear this line the same day. I had one of the mentor in Yeshiva, I was in 770. He told us we were for bringing the same night. And he said, somebody in the Rebbe's family said a very, very important line. I want to tell you. That's how he told us. We understood right away, you can say such a line. Hmm. And he said the same night, it's already the news started to spread. Only this time came out because that was a breakthrough. That was a bomb.
Where was this court? Where was it?
In New York.
In Manhattan? Was
yes.
Southern District of Manhattan, yes.
I'm just thinking, no way it was not documented. Documentary or something like a movie about this.
There's not a movie, but there is books about it. But you were not allowed to bring cameras to court.
Oh, it was
court.
Not recorded?
Recorded? No, tapes probably there is. Yeah, but not video.
Reporters
and people could not come in with cameras.
Long time ago.
But still, from a documented standpoint, like you...
That's when you had the court illustrator, and that's how you found...
Yeah, there is illustrations. Yeah, there is illustrations of the court. Sketches, yeah. Sketches.
Remember, a lot of hearings today aren't recorded or video.
Some court cases are not.
Okay, we'll continue the next paragraph.
Visibly
moved.
Yeah,
Sifton.
The only expression of the personal reaction he uttered during the entire duration of the proceedings, says part to himself and part to the assembled.
Remarkable. What he said was, it was very hard to know what he thinks. He was a very serious person, very controlled. He was sitting and listening. You never knew one thing, which side is going. He spoke very little. He was very official, very fair to both sides. And you know, everybody sitting there, you never know what the guy thinks. But this, when he finished, he said, remarkable.
The defendant lawyer subsequently objected to the admission of this testimony on technical grounds. The judge accepted, but the deep impact of the Rebbetzin were evident to all.
The point is, he heard that. It didn't make a difference if he accepted that as a testimony or not. He got the message.
What's the technical ground for?
Yeah.
You know, they always can find an excuse. I don't know. Yeah, they'll find a reason. You know, they can always argue.
They wanted the testimony and then they objected to
it. Yeah, sure.
Makes sense. They probably protested she wasn't born when the Torah was written.
I know what they said. I found a good excuse was why it's not a... But the point is... Such a line nobody else can say beside the Rebbe himself or his wife, you understand? Mm. who can say that I cannot say that you belong to him? I mean, it's only you can say it. Only the Rebbe's wife was able to make such a statement. And really, that's what stands for all what Chabad is all about. The Rebbe never had anything for himself, never needed anything. If you see, the people went there, you saw the Rebbe's study, the Rebbe's office. There's books. There's nothing there. He lived there after his wife passed away. He lived in his office. He had a bed in the middle of the room. And then he didn't need anything. He was completely spiritual. He didn't need anything. And once there was one of the secretaries, was his driver, taking him. Really went to the oil. His father-in-law's grave said, the only place the Rebbe went for 4 years, he never left 770. Never left New York, anywhere. He never went anywhere. Then the car, it was a car for many years, I think for 12 years. The car broke down a few times when the Rebbe was in. They bought a new car. Rebbe came out, I was there. Everything happened there this year. There was a big, very... Rebbe came out, the secretary tells the Rebbe, this new car was donated by this person, by one of the Rebbe's big Hasidim, rich man. The Rebbe said, tell him, the Rebbe quoted, it's written in the book, in the book of Proverbs, I think, a person who hates present lives long. The Rebbe quoted this line. He told him, tell him, thank you very much, and I want back the old car. Mm-hmm. They knew that the Rebbe is capable for this. The old car was right there. Mm-hmm. They moved the old car back. And the Rebbe stood at his desk. The Rebbe was very unhappy that they put him in a situation that he had to deny the car and have to say to somebody, no. It was, and the Rebbe was continuing. And then when the old car broke down completely, the Rebbe said, lease a car. You're not buying a new car. The Rebbe didn't need it. And the Rebbe was, like, 3 months later, the Rebbe spoke one of the four bringers. The Rebbe, like, somehow it came in. They wanted to buy me a new car. The Rebbe says, I don't need new cars. The whole car is going, it's doing a very good job. It is going to very good places, basically. Then, by the Rebbe, by the Chabad Rebbe's, their whole life was dedicated to the Hasidim, to the Jewish people. He didn't have anything for himself. Yeah?
Did he have an escort when he went anywhere or not?
Yeah, in the later years, he had an escort of police going to the oil
like
and coming back.
You mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, because there were threats and this. Sure, he had an escort, yeah. And also because they wanted to go fast, not to be stuck by every light and every traffic in New York. Never ending. Now, we're going to read the testimony of Elie Wiesel, what he said. Elie Wiesel, by the way, said that he never went to court to testimony for anybody. He made a decision. He's not going anywhere, ever. The only time he broke the rule was he went for the Rebbe.
Who is Elie Wiesel?
Elie Wiesel was one of the most famous Holocaust survivors. You know the book Night? You ever read the book Night?
Read it, it's about it.
It was a very, very famous Jew. Yeah. He became almost the face of the Holocaust survivors in the world.
One who hunt down every single Nazi.
Yeah. He didn't hunt down the Nazis. No, that was somebody else. That was
He was the face of the Holocaust.
He was face of the Holocaust. The Holocaust. Yeah. He wrote many books. He was a very famous speaker. Yeah. I'm sure you will read about him. You'll remember.
Night is not a long book. You could probably read it in like an hour and a half.
Yeah, but if you read Night, then you got to read Dawn.
No. You read Night once, then you cannot sleep many nights.
I was gonna say, yeah. Michael looked at me. I'm thinking this is probably not a fun book.
No, but you
will appreciate it.
You will not worry. Yeah.
It's not an uplifting, but it's good.
Yeah. Actually, when we had the grand opening for this room, we had a big party at downtown, and Elie Wiesel was there. And
yeah, Elie Wiesel came, and we opened. It was a big opening. We had Elie Wiesel in downtown in the Intercontinental Hotel. 700 people came. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, we had a great party.
Yes.
Elie Wiesel testified about the subtleties of the Chassid Rebbe relationship. It is not the Rebbe who chooses the Chassid.
The Chassid.
It is the Chassid who chooses the Rebbe, he's always explained. But once that choice is made, it is boundless. It is total loyalty. Therefore, the Rebbe owes the Chassid total loyalty. So the Rebbe must have for the community not only total loyalty, but total generosity and compassion. Even more, he must have total responsibility. That's why he is a Rebbe.
Basically, Elie Wiesel said this idea that a Chassid chooses a Rebbe. A Rebbe doesn't go around and says, oh, I choose you. I like you. A Chassid connects to a Rebbe. But the moment they connect, it's a total loyalty. It's a complete devotion forever, for life and for death. And because you get it back. We're talking about real rabbis. Not everyone who calls himself rabbi, you understand that. Talk about the real thing. Then it's such a connection. It's a soul connection. Then the chassid can be in the other side of the world. He will feel the rabbi. The rabbi will feel his chassid that is in need. And he, there is countless stories about the rabbi who reached out to people because he said, "What's go calling? Tell to call, tell the secretary, call this chassid, find out what's going on there," and things like this, like unbelievable.
It's like elaboration or explanation. What? Wife of Reb said.
Exactly, exactly. Most explaining, yes. Wiesel further
emphasized that Chabad Hasidic life decisively rejects the notion that the Rebbe's may require personal wealth as a sign of their unique status.
Exactly. For a Rebbe, in Chabad, the Rebbe needs wealth. It's a whole thing was unheard of, was not needed for him together.
New York Times report. The ruling was received with joy in the streets.
Oh, the 5th of today, a year after the court case was over, was finally the issue was and there was the ruling, the judge.
Took him a year.
To make the decision.
No. He said it will take 3 months, and then he was involved in a financial case, a big financial case, and he didn't have the time to go back to this court. But the Rebbe over this year, it was not easy on the Rebbe, and because of that, of the Hasidim. The Rebbe was very, very stressed about what the ruling will be. And when the ruling came, and it came out, then Chabad won this case 100%, not 99%. 101%. Everything belongs to the movement, nothing belongs to them. You can imagine what was going on there. I was in 770. I went to Israel because of papers for a month and a half. I came back 5 days before the ruling. I didn't miss the party, that's the main thing. I was there, it was unbelievable. There were dancing going on for 7 days. Dancing and drinking. It was such a party that you never saw in your life. If the Rebbe wouldn't stop the party, we would dance until today. It was going on day and night with music and food and drinking. They literally 7 nights of celebration, a whole night of celebration. Thousands of people came from all over the world. It was going on there, something you never heard and you never saw in your life.
I can see in everybody's eyes, he still remembers his drink.
You bet. I you know how much I drink. But it was such a joy. And but the Rebbe himself, because the judge left the option for them to appeal, the Rebbe was not relaxed. The Rebbe was not celebrating. The Hasidim was celebrating. And the Rebbe spoke about that. And for 7 days, he gave speeches every night. But you saw on the Rebbe himself that he's not there yet. Because it was still an appeal. And it was an appeal event later. And the appeal, Chabad won it again completely. And only then, the next year, the Rebbe kind of celebrated it.
Stress on him.
Okay, now you can read it.
Did they recover the books that were sold?
Oh, yeah. Chabad paid back the money for the people who paid for it.
So they did get them back.
And they gave them back because even they were in Israel. You need to understand. The Rebbe said when he spoke about it the first time, he says, anybody who takes a book to his home, you should know that it's a bomb. That's how the Rebbe used. And you never know when it'll blow up. That's how the Rebbe used. He said, you should know it belongs to my father-in-law. And any time, any minute you have it in your house, it's like a bomb that you don't know when it'll blow up. That's how the Rebbe used the word. Mm. You know, when the people who buy the books hear the word from the Rebbe, there were many Jews all over the world made an effort to help Chabad to recover the books from the people who bought it. And eventually, you know, a person who buys a book is usually a religious Jew. And he buys it because it's a very holy book. When he hears from the Rebbe that this book is a bomb, if not you, your wife, your cousin, will tell you, you are out of your mind if you keep it in your house. Get the money back and get rid of the book.
But a bomb as a financial bomb?
No, not a financial bomb. And nothing to do with finance.
They probably profited because they knew whatever
sure.
They bought it.
No. They got back the money that they paid for, not a cent more. Not a cent more. The Rebbe said not to give him a cent more. You're not allowed to pay a cent more. They're like just like redeeming people, according to Jewish law, you're not allowed to pay more than the vote. And the Rebbe said books are like living beings. Don't pay a cent more, the Rebbe said. Only what they paid. And they gave, but they recovered all the books There were many were sold in Israel. The Rebbe said to build in Israel a special institution, and the book are stored in Israel in Kfar Chabad. The Rebbe didn't need them to should come to 770, as long as they're under Chabad jurisdiction. Belongs to Chabad.
Was your father involved with the recoveries?
No, no, my father was not involved at all, no. There were plenty of people.
Do you know how many volumes were?
I think 470 books were bought back.
Wow. He stole 470 books?
Wow.
And I think it's not. I think it's not even everything. The books in Israel were separate. I don't remember the number exactly.
Was he punished in any way?
Did he have to pay back?
About the guilt, didn't he have a conscience? Thinking like
people with conscious,
even if they're mine, like
people with conscious. No, he had no conscience. He had no personality. It was more his wife who controlled them.
What happened to him?
He lived and died. Nothing special happened to him. Nothing. Expired. No, he died. He actually died.
There was no expiration. It was just flat out death.
Sorry to hear that.
Mm.
Right, so the ruling was received with joy in the streets in front of the headquarters of the plaintiff, the Lubavitch Movement at 770 Eastern Parkway in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn. Ascetic men in traditional black garb danced in circles to the music of a pleasant.
But this is from a New York reporter. In the New York Times reporter, he came only a little bit. He didn't realize what happened for 7 days.
Hmm.
Now is what the Rebbe talked about it. How the Rebbe saw it. Go ahead, please.
The lesson. On the 5th of Kevet, after hearing of the victorious court ruling, the Rebbe spoke about the day's daily study portion, about the dramatic story of Joseph, the viceroy of Egypt, revealing his identity to his brothers who had sold him into slavery 22 years earlier. Sensing their fear that Joseph might now exact revenge from them for their treacherous deed, he puts them at ease with his famous words of reassurance, as quoted in the Torah. And now it was not you who sent me here to slavery in Egypt. Rather, it was God who sent me so that I could provide for you later on when there would be a drought in the land.
See, the Rebbe spoke about the parsha of the week. The parsha of this week is that Joseph was finally revealed himself to his brothers. Can you imagine? He tells them, I'm Joseph, by the way, guys. Mm-hmm. They run away from him. He had to prove them he spoke Hebrew. He showed them that he's circumcised. That he had to prove that that's Joseph. Maybe after hearing all the stories, he decided to drive them crazy even more. Says, I'm Joseph. In any case, when they were afraid now, you know what it means? The ruler of Egypt is the guy that you wanted to kill? You wanted to throw him into the pit and you sold him as a slave? You're finished. Then Joseph told them, don't be afraid. You think you sold me to Egypt? God brought me here. God sent me as a messenger to be here to save you. God knew there's going to be a famine. And he sent me as a messenger ahead of you to be here in Egypt, to save Egypt and to save you. That's why I'm here. Then don't feel bad that you sold me. You were playing in the big picture. You were messengers of God. Can you imagine how Joseph looked at it? Now, then the Rebbe said, we must see what is the message going through so much from 1985. From the summer of 1985, the Rebbe discovered the story until 87, until the January of 87. When was it the ruling? I forgot. At the beginning of 87, right? It was December or January. I don't remember what was the secular date at that time. In any case, the point is, the Rebbe said, what can we learn from it? There is a lesson, the same story as Joseph looks on things, then that's all from God, must be a lesson for us.
It's interesting that it's the same time, the same.
Yeah, it's all from
Vigash, like this week of Vigash, that's the confrontation, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that it's time somehow it works?
Not sometimes, it's all from God. Sure, go ahead.
The lesson the Rebbe said it's quite clear. When Jews find themselves in an undesirable situation, even after it has passed and they are relieved from the challenge, like Joseph and his brothers when they had been reunited, they must remember and remind others that the experience was not a coincidence, God forbid, but a heavenly design to achieve a purpose for which God put them in that situation in the first place.
There is a purpose, there is a goal, everything is meant to be, it's all Bashar, there is no mistakes. then the Rebbe is asking himself and trying to teach the Hasidim, if such a thing happened and such a challenge, and you know they were challenging, they said, the Rebbe said it belongs to the umbrella of the Chabad movement. He said this umbrella, this organization was dormant for so many years. Nobody did anything. There was no, you don't see anything in record. The Rebbe said, what umbrella of Chabad movement? It's all Chabad movement. Chabad movement is dormant. Chabad movement is not active. How can you even think like this, Sachin? The Rebbe, but here is where the Rebbe is going with it. Continue.
Alluding to Chabad's foundational Yad Tes Kislev celebration, whence the Alter Rebbe derived the lesson of growth and expansion from challenges, both on our material plane as well as the heavenly abode, to his work of spreading Hasidim, we too, the Rebbe said, must learn from those who disputed the movement's veracity by increasing the work means.
We just talked about it a few more weeks ago when the Alter Rebbe was in jail. Is because he spread the Hasidic teachings, his two rabbis, the Baal Shem Tov and the Magid, came to visit him from heaven, and he asked him why I suffer so much. He said because you're giving out secrets are not allowed to give out. Then he asked him, should I stop? So no, because you already went all through all this. Not only you shouldn't stop, you should even go even further, stronger. Then after Yutes Kislev, after this, he came out from the jail by the Tsar. Then the Chabad movement really started to be picked up. It was in St. Petersburg. That in Chabad there is the expression before St. Petersburg and after St. Petersburg. Mm. It's like before the challenge and after the challenge. After the challenge, Chabad, the Rebbe says, we also have to take a lesson from what happened after the challenge. We won the case. Now what? So, want to continue?
Yeah. So while some claim that Lubavitch is not active.
They claim that Lubavitch is not active. Go ahead.
Despite the obvious quantum growth that the movement has been across the globe in the 35 years since the six rabbis arrived to America in 1940, we, the rabbi said, must still learn and apply a lesson from these claims to our lives and commit ourselves to growing and expanding even more the actualization of our generation's mandate to make this world a dwelling place for God.
The Rebbe said like this, if somebody can take it to court and claim and accuse Chabad of not being active, even Chabad is active is an understatement. But it means that God is telling us you have to do much more. That the possibilities, the Rebbe said, we accomplished the Chabad movement, the Hasidim accomplished a world all over the globe. Since his father-in-law passed away in 1950, and that was 1986, 80, when it started, the whole thing. 35 years later, Chabad was a million times bigger. But Rebbe said that means that, but still, if somebody comes, it means it comes out from God, from God's mouth, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Put in this guy, in this lawyer's mouth, to go into to complain that Chabad is not active, it means that we have a message here. We have to become even more active. Chabad, since then, became took it on a whole different level of outreach. All the boys who were in 770 in these years, they all became Chabad rabbis. It wasn't so common before that. Because it's not easy, you know, the beginning is pretty bumpy. But because we saw the Rebbe's commitment to this whole idea and going through the suffering to see how the Rebbe suffers and he's upset and we became so committed and so close to the Rebbe that there was no question we are going no matter what to the moon, but we are going to open Chabad house, no matter where it is, to do what the Rebbe wants. Continue.
The Rebbe continued his teaching by
concluded
his teaching by citing the closing verses of that day's Torah portion when Jacob, back at home in the land of Canaan, received the great news that his son Joseph, in whom he had been mourning for years under the impression that he had died, was actually alive. Then, upon seeing the wagons Joseph sent him, which carried his long-lost son's symbolic message that not only was he alive in a physical sense, but he had remained faithful to the teaching of Jacob and his forebears. The verse concludes, and the spirit of their father Jacob was restored.
Okay, and the day that the judge issued the ruling was the day we read in the Torah that the life of Jacob was restored. Vatechi ruach Yaakov avim. Hear the news that his father is alive. The good news came to him that his father is alive, and the son is alive, and he was revived. You know, it's written that for 22 years, when Joseph was gone, Jacob was mourning. He was sitting, so to speak, on a small chair and was mourning for his father, for his son. And he never recovered, no matter how much people, how many, the Bible says, how many people came and told him, still be happy about your other children. He couldn't get over it. Then you can imagine after 22 years like this, when they came and told him, Joseph is alive, they came back home. This was the day the Rebbe got the ruling. And the library belongs to Chabad. Then talking about the end of God. That day, the Rebbe spoke about that, and was in the Bible, of the learning of the day. You know, the Parsha is divided into seven aliyahs, right? Seven, you call up seven people, seven aliyahs. We learn every day, the first aliyah on Sunday, the second aliyah on Monday, the it was on a Tuesday. And the third aliyah was about the story that they came back home, and Jacob's life, Jacob's spirit was restored. That happened on the same day the Rebbe got the ruling. Huh? Not Dina, it was Serach Bat Asher. Yeah. But the point is, then the Rebbe said, what made Jacob's life spirit restored? Let's say they come and tell him, yeah, Joseph is the ruler of Egypt. What he wanted to know about, now he looks like Jewish. Now he looks like. Selling the wagons, Joseph sent with them the wagons. Wagons in Hebrew are called agalot. There is a law in the Bible about Egla Rufa, written if a person killed them, if there is a homicide on the street and nobody knows who killed them, and then the community has to bring a calf and slaughter them by the water, and the rabbis have to make a prayer, they say, make a statement, we did not spill the blood, we are not responsible for it. It's a law of Egla Rufa, it's called. The last laws, the Talmud says, the last laws that Jacob was teaching Joseph before he left 22 years before was about Egla Rufa. Sending him this agalot, it was a statement. I remember what you're teaching me. I remember, I'm still observant. I didn't give up on my tradition. That's what get the spirit of Jacob alive. You know, your long lost son. Oh, you found him, he's alive, I'm so happy. But tell me how he looks like. Is he still a Jew or he became a complete chvezvos? Okay. The Rebbe connected.
Why was Jacob's spirit restored only upon seeing his son's adherence to the path he taught him? The Rebbe connected this seamlessly with an idea he had expounded upon times earlier that year, that of the Talmud's declaration that Jacob, our forefather, did not die, because just as his children are alive, so too is he alive. In earlier talks, the Rebbe expounded on the profound implications of Jacob being alive and applied the same principle to the sixth Rebbe. The Rebbe's very life, even when he was physically alive in body, was entirely devoted exclusively to the study and dissemination of Torah and the love and fear of God that it inspires in his students, and his very work in that regard is continuing now after his passing in even greater measure. As such, the Rebbe said, he is alive.
Yeah, in similar fashion.
In similar fashion, when Jacob's life lost its vitality after suffering the loss of his son, it was the recognition that his child was spiritually alive that restored his grieving spirit and made him alive
again.
You
see, if Joseph is not alive, if Joseph is not Jewish, Jacob is not alive. You understand? That's how it goes. Because what means he's alive after his death? That his kids continue is tradition. If one of his children is not continuing, a part of him is not alive. That's why it's not written alive by Abraham and Isaac, because everyone had a son who didn't continue the tradition, Ishmael, and then Esau. Jacob, all his children continue the tradition. That's why by him it's not written dead. It's written then that's what he says. That only then he was alive, and he knew that his son continued. Continue.
In hindsight, the entire experience of
Hey Tevis is the fifth of Tevis today,
and the year of pain leading up to it gave and gives new depth to the concept of the everlasting life of a selflessly devoted tzaddik and leader like the Rebbe, and the great responsibility and merit our entire generation has to restore his spirit by living and emulating his teachings. Harking back to the Rebbe's Haytavis prayers at his father-in-law's resting place, the experience also adds many layers of depth and vitality to the experience of visiting the Rebbe's Ohel and praying to God there. Far from being a morbid place, it is very much vital and alive, a place for personal and communal blessing and guidance.
See, if the Rebbe is alive means, the Rebbe basically in this old talks laid the foundation out to look and after his life. Yeah, he passed away, but he's still alive. Because as long as we are alive and we are learning his teaching, we are continuing his traditions, we are spreading Judaism, we're reaching out to other Jews, then he's alive. His ideas are alive. When he was alive, what was the Rebbe? His white beard? That was what his message. His message is still alive. Actually, the Rebbe, when he spoke about his father-in-law, used to say, Terry, the other guy says he died 35 years ago. I said, my father-in-law is 35 years more alive than before. He was never as alive as now. That's how the Rebbe looked at it. Go ahead, finish it. The Rebbe's
conclusion was that it was not a coincidence that this victory happened around Torah books. We must use this opportunity to buy Jewish books and build up individual collections of holy works.
Then the Rebbe's message, what should we do on this day? Buy another Jewish book. That was the message. Add another Jewish book to your library. And in Chabad, there is many sales of books, and the bookstores in Crown Heights and everywhere are full with people. People are buying books like there is no tomorrow. Then what we can do, how we celebrate it, I always like to do this. What's the bottom line? And what should I do today? Saying L'chaim is nice, for bringing is nice, but... And the Rebbe also used it, like, because when the boys was dancing for 7 days, the Rebbe says, it's about the books, guy, go back to the books.
After the seventh day.
It was such a shock. The Rebbe laid us down in one speech, what was us from the seventh heaven, right to reality. Go back to the books, the party is over.
So we had the bigger party.
We had a much happier party.